Hey, this is Scott Love. Thanks for joining us on our latest episode of Malk Talk. Today, we're talking with Executive Director Nakia Gray. Nakia, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks, Scott. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Indeed. And as we head into the holiday season and the end of the year, I was thinking we could talk a bit about the state of the industry. What were some of the biggest issues this year for legal talent? And what will you be watching as we head into 2026?
Oh boy, Scott, there is just so much going on right now that could have a significant impact on the legal industry and particularly legal talent. The biggest, though, has to be the Trump administration and the president's targeting of law firms over the clients that they represent, as well as their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. That's died down now, but it certainly had a lot of fallout, right? We had 9 law firms settle with the administration, one that had been named an executive order, and 8 additional firms who preemptively sought settlements. And then there were the 4 firms who fought the executive orders and 1 permanent injunctions, although all of those cases are on appeals. We'll have to wait to see what happens there. But this has been a completely unprecedented situation that's really sent shockwaves through the entire legal community in the U.S. and the world, truly. It's a completely unprecedented situation.
It is. And do you think this is the last that we've seen of these types of orders against law firms, Nakia?
You know, I don't think anyone except maybe the president himself knows the answer to that. Certainly, there is nothing stopping the administration jumpstarting its campaign against big law again. But given the chilling effect these orders have had on the legal industry, I just don't think it needs to.
Right. And what do you think has been the impact of these orders for legal talent?
Well, there's obviously been a lot of fallout from these orders, but the primary impact when it comes to legal talent has to be the loss of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. As I outlined in my letter to members in March, the vast majority of this program was and still is lawful. Unfortunately, though, a number of legal employers have now ended their initiatives, including many who have not been targets of the administration. And all of this is having a real impact on NALT members. NALT members are the ones in law firms and other institutions who do this work. You know, we've seen members having their titles changed and their job responsibilities reassigned, and even a few who have lost their jobs, although fortunately not many there. So it's just a really tough situation and one that I'll be watching closely as it continues to play out over the next year, as well as paying attention closely to that NALP data so that we can monitor the impact on what all this has on the diversity of the legal profession.
Right. And what about the law schools? What were the biggest issues this year for them?
Well, the law schools are certainly being impacted by the administration's policies as well, although it's more indirectly. The primary targets of the administration has been the universities, and it's been focused on investigating their endowments and their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. Harvard has been the most notable institution to come under scrutiny there, but there's certainly been others like Columbia, UPenn, UCLA, Brown, and a few others. But even the universities who are not under direct scrutiny have still been impacted by the policy changes of the administration. Earlier this year, we saw many universities having significant grants terminated because those grants were no longer determined to be in alignment with the priorities of the administration. And we may see even more universities being impacted because of the new restrictions proposed on student visas. International students typically pay full tuition. U.S. students do not. So the lower tuition that those U.S. students pay is subsidized by that higher tuition the international students pay. Now, those rule changes are still in the public comment period, so it could change. But this year, we've also seen a huge drop in the international students just due to other policy changes made by the administration that makes the U.S. seem less welcoming to them. In fact, you know, international student arrivals in August reported at being a 4-year low, and that itself is estimated at costing the universities billions in lost tuition revenue. So all of this gives us a sense of how significant the impact could be if we see the fewer international students enrolling at U.S. universities because of those proposed restrictions. So while none of this is directed specifically at the law schools, all of it's impacting them if they're part of a university system, which the vast majority are. These are huge financial losses, and the universities will look to the law schools and everywhere else they can to make them up. So I think another big issue in the legal industry to watch over the next year is how the universities respond to these budget shortfalls, what happens to those student visas, and to what extent all of this impacts the law schools.
Right. And I understand another issue that's come up this year for the law schools is ABA Council accreditation. What's happening there and how might that affect legal talent?
Yeah, Scott, this is a huge one. And let me say for listeners who want to understand this better, I wrote an article in the September Now Bulletin Plus magazine detailing this issue. And we also included an interview with Jen Rosado Pereira, the managing director of the ABA Council, because this is just such a big issue to be watching. The council's status as the accreditor of law schools is under attack at both the federal level and the state level. At the federal level, the Department of Education recognizes certain accreditors for the purposes of accrediting schools for Title IV funding, so for federal student loan funding. The council status as a recognized accreditor comes up for review next year, and there's a lot of speculation as to whether they're going to pass that review. That, though, is not that big of a deal, except for those few independent law schools. As I said a moment ago, the vast majority of schools are part of a university system, and they actually rely on that university accreditation for the purposes of Title IV funding. So nothing would change for those law schools if the ABA Council was no longer recognized by the Department of Ed. The much, much bigger issue is the state-level attacks. Currently, most state Supreme Courts require a lawyer to have a JD degree from an ABA Council-accredited law school in order for that lawyer to be eligible for admissions to that state bar. At the end of September, we saw the Supreme Court of Texas issuing a tentative order stating that it intends to end its reliance on the ABA Council and saying instead that it's going to take responsibility for the oversight of law schools itself. And the Supreme Courts of Florida, Ohio, and Texas are all considering similar orders. Now, we don't yet know what that Texas order is going to mean for future lawyers. The Texas Supreme Court has stated it does intend to preserve the portability of Texas law school degrees. But, you know, for that to actually work, the 49 other state Supreme Courts have to agree to do the same thing. And we don't know if they're going to do that. We don't know if they're going to recognize degrees from non-ABA accredited law schools. And so that's where my concern comes in. Currently, the ABA Council provides a national accreditation system, which enables mobility for lawyers. The risk with what Texas and these other states are doing is that we may end up with a patchwork of accreditation systems that restrict the portability of licenses. And I do think that would be catastrophic to the careers of future graduates. You know, modern legal careers require mobility, and mobility requires a national accreditation scheme. So this is definitely an issue to be watching. The Texas Supreme Court is going to issue its final order in January, and we expect orders from the other state Supreme Courts any day now.
So we've been hearing rumblings about the work of the CLEAR Committee. Does that figure into what you're talking about here with accreditation, Nikaya?
You know, I do think it does. And for listeners who don't know, the CLEAR Committee is this joint committee of the Conference of Chief Justices and the Conference of State Court Administrators. The committee itself was comprised of chief justices from various state Supreme Courts. And the committee seems to have really originated out of the justices' concern over the access to justice crisis. And for the past 2 years, they've been investigating and preparing recommendations in three specific areas: readiness for practice, admissions to the bar, and then promoting public interest careers to students. In late July, the CLEAR Committee issued its final report, which included 9 recommendations. Now, these were very high-level recommendations, but recommendation 3 was that the state court should, quote, encourage law school accreditation that serves the public. And the more detailed explanation given for that recommendation was that the accreditation process should promote innovation, experimentation, and cost-effective legal education. Now, that's not a direct statement against the council, but I do think it's an indication that the CLEAR Committee and the chief justices serving on it are questioning the council's effectiveness in producing practice-ready graduates, and whether by overregulation the council has stifled innovation and experimentation and just increased the cost of legal education. And it sounds like they're encouraging the state Supreme Courts to consider alternatives. So I do think this all ties into what we're seeing with the Texas Supreme Court and possibly other courts ending their reliance on the ABA Council for accreditation purposes. And it suggests that we're going to see more state Supreme Courts looking into alternatives. So again, this is a major issue that I think could impact legal talent, and I'll be watching closely over the next year.
So one thing I've noticed that you haven't mentioned yet, Nikaya, in terms of the state of the legal industry is artificial intelligence, AI. Do you see that as a major issue for legal talent?
Oh, most definitely. From my point of view, the story of AI in the legal industry is at its core a story about people, right? It's about how they work, how they learn, how they build their careers in a profession that is really starting to change. So I do think it's an issue to be watching closely. That said, I think we're still 2 to 3 years out from really seeing its impact. So it's not necessarily an issue for 2026, but it's an issue to be watching.
So when we start to see its impact, how do you see AI affecting law firms specifically?
Yeah, Scott, that's a complicated question to answer. You know, given what we do here at NALP, I'll focus in on how I think this all relates to talent. The short answer is AI is starting to change the way lawyers practice law. And with that, I do think it's going to change how many lawyers law firms need and the expertise they're going to need to have. I mean, the thing here is that law firms have spent the last 3 years largely doing this should we, shouldn't we debate when it comes to Gen AI. That is now over, right? Law firms now largely recognize that Gen AI is essential to their business. And as the tool develops and lawyers become more proficient in it, it's going to replace a lot of that more routine legal work that lawyers today spend a lot of time doing and billing for. And this is where we could see those changes in the law firm business model. And it could be quite painful for some firms as they go through this change. It means that fewer lawyers are going to be needed for that more routine legal work that make up so much of the billings in law firms today, which means that revenue per engagement will decrease as there'll be less billings on each matter. And the leverage model will likely shift, likely decreasing and shifting to this more senior mix, all of which could decrease profits and headcounts at law firms.
Right. And when you say the word leverage, for listeners that don't know, can you explain and elaborate on what that means in the law firm context?
Yeah, great question. I do think a lot of folks don't understand leverage, and it's a really, really important metric for law firms. Leverage is that ratio of non-equity timekeepers to equity partners. So it's the ratio of income partners, associates, staff attorneys, paralegals, and so forth to equity partners. So leverage models are highly correlated to the profitability of firms. Higher leverage models are generally associated with greater profits per equity partner because you have more billers per equity partner. So if that leverage decreases, that means you have less billers. And if it shifts to a more senior mix, it means it's also a more expensive model because you're paying those individuals more, both of which reduce profits.
Right. So what do you think these changes mean for the entry-level job market, Nikaya?
Yeah. So again, I do think we're a few years out from seeing any major shifts in the entry-level job market. When we do, though, I think it could be very hard hit if law schools are not paying attention. I've talked to a few firms who are already starting to adjust their entry-level hiring in response to AI. And over the next few years, I think we're going to see more. I do want to be very clear there. Though law firms are not going to stop hiring, right? To have senior lawyers do that more sophisticated work that Gen AI can't replace, they need to hire and train junior lawyers. But overall, they're going to need fewer of them. The outstanding question is, when exactly is that going to happen? And will schools have adjusted class size so that when it does, the market isn't flooded with this disproportionate number of law school graduates that it can't absorb? So class size is another trend that we should all be watching closely. And it's one that has me a little concerned because schools have increased their enrollment for the past 2 years, which means we are going to see larger graduating classes again in 2027 and 2028.
Right. So with all these changes that you mentioned, what will that mean for early career associates?
You know, I think associates are going to have a much shorter runway to learn and become profitable. A lot of law firms right now don't really evaluate junior associates on profitability. And by that, I mean, you know, how much of that time the associate bills is actually collected on. It's just accepted that the firm is going to need to write off a lot of that time in the attorney's first few years of practice. And so long as the associate's doing good work, you know, meeting their billing requirements, everything else is considered fine. And it really isn't until more like the third or fourth year that most firms begin evaluating associates on profitability, and some firms are even later than that. But with revenue per engagement decreasing, that padding that allows firms to carry unprofitable junior associates for a limited time as they learn is going to be decreasing as well. And that means that firms are going to start expecting future first-year associates to start performing like today's fourth-year associates much more quickly. So how to support these early-stage lawyers in making that transition is going to be a major issue, I think, for PD professionals in the years ahead.
Right. So what AI-related training do you think employers will want to see from new hires coming out of law school?
You know, Scott, I don't think that's well articulated yet. In private practice, at least, a lot of firms are focused right now on building out their own AI tools and training the workforce to utilize those tools effectively. So I think that AI adoption is still new enough that employers expect that they're going to have to provide that training, at least for now. As Gen AI gets more embedded, though, in the way lawyers practice law, graduates who have that level of AI fluency will have an edge over those who don't. And I expect it eventually will become a base level competency that employers expect graduates to have coming out of law school, like they do right now for the ability to use tools like Westlaw and LexisNexis and so forth. And we're seeing law schools already proactively adapting their curriculum to ensure that their students do have that base level of fluency by the time they graduate. Every few days, I'm seeing schools announce that they've got a new certificate program or courses in AI and the legal practice. So I expect in short order, we're going to see the vast majority of schools having some type of AI training for students.
Well, that's really interesting, Nakai. And it's been a really big year for legal talent, and there's a lot to be watching as we head into 2026. I appreciate your time, Nakai, and all that NALP is doing to support the legal industry.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate the time.